Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 186 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Remember that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you, and I do love to hear from you. Send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor this show, please contact me. You can make a one-time donation via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com or make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. And now let's go to today's interview, which is another personal story that's actually very deep. Raul Erix de Palma today is a healthy man living and working in Spain, where he's the manager of a legal office in Malaga, focusing on employment law. But he wasn't always so healthy. Back in 1995, he was undergoing heart surgery brought on by almost 10 years of multiple drug addictions. Shortly after that, he learned he was HIV positive. But for some reasons that we will discuss, he never even thought about taking the recommended AIDS medication. He survived the heart surgery, overcame his addictions, and focused on his physical and spiritual health. I most recently saw him at a virus conference in the south of France past June 2018. He has been HIV positive, healthy, and without AIDS drugs for over 20 years now. He's been an important source of information, inspiration, and support for more recently diagnosed people who have questioned whether the pharmaceutical approach to HIV is best for them. Welcome to the show, Raul.
Hello, David. Welcome.
So you were a drug addict from, according to something you wrote, from 1986 until about 1995. What were the factors that led you to addiction?
Well, that for me is a mystery. I mean, I'm not quite sure. I don't have a sole answer for that. I don't know. Maybe it's a cumulative different issues that make me go into the addiction, because I wasn't outside the cities or the poor families or things like that. So I don't know if it was boring that made me go into drug addiction, lack of expectations as a young man in a little village. I lived in Marbella in Malaga, the south of Spain, very little village. And maybe it was all or just all together, but I don't have a unique reason.
So many people who become addicted mention factors like loneliness, rejection, discrimination, lack of self-esteem. I mean, did you suffer from any of those?
Yes, well, I suffer from that, but I realized it was when I was already under the addiction. Before that, maybe I had a lot of problems with the family or since the childhood, that maybe I couldn't be able to express it. And then in some way, it led me to starting the addiction. But I'm not quite sure. I mean, that is something that could have different answers.
Yes. Well, I guess that's not so important for our discussion today. The fact is that you were an addict. And what drugs were you taking in that almost 10-year period?
The most I did was heroin. But at the end, in the last 2 or 3 years, I started mixing heroin with cocaine. And I used to have it intravenous, the heroin and cocaine together. So that make my body to go in a very bad situation and very quickly.
Right.
Because of the cocaine, intravenous cocaine. And then that affects the most my heart and the circulatory system,
right,
of the blood, and that's why came that affection in my heart, that a valve was not working good and I had to be hospitalized.
Based on what you wrote, you had heart valve replacement. You had 21 units of blood while you were undergoing a surgery, and you said that was because you had poor platelet function. So you were bleeding and kept bleeding, presumably. It was hard for the bleeding to stop. You also said you had very poor kidney function, 20%. And they also told you that you were hepatitis C positive at the same time.
Yes. This is when I came into the hospital, in my admittance in the hospital. They saw I was very bad. They didn't know what was wrong with me, but they put me in a room with an isolated room with everybody has to come in, you know, with masks.
Right.
Because they knew I was something wrong, but they didn't know.
An isolation room.
I was there because I couldn't even walk in the street. But I have to say that I didn't go on my own. In those days, I think I would have died maybe a few days later anywhere. And was some person, a person that I knew, that he saw I was very bad in the street, and he took me to the hospital. Mm-hmm. Against my will, I didn't want to. But I couldn't resist because I wasn't strong enough. So I just said, okay, I'm going to the hospital, and after they see I am an addict, they will send me out of the hospital and I will come back to the city. But it didn't happen. They just put me in a room, and then I wasn't able not even to stand anymore. When I was in the bed, I could not move. It was too bad. It's like my last efforts was to get to the hospital.
Right. But if this man hadn't taken you, you probably would have died on the street.
Yes, in the streets, in the places where I used to be, and maybe one more week, but I already have this broken valve in my heart that was bleeding.
Right.
And I had this flood in the two...
In the pulmonary area, so the blood was leaving your heart and filling up your body. So yes, you wouldn't have lasted very long. They obviously did a good job on the heart surgery.
Yes.
But I assume that you thought you were just going to go back on the street afterwards, that your life wasn't going to change that much. But obviously at some point things changed. So what happened after the surgery to start making changes in your life?
You wouldn't believe it, but I even try sometimes to get an overdose when I was in the streets. Several times I tried, but like my body resisted the overdoses.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, when I was in the hospital and very close to death or to the last minutes of my life, then I realized that wasn't the thing I want for me in my life. I realized I didn't want to feel pain. And then I start looking at the good things in life. It was like all the opposite that I was a few hours before. And that was a change that was 180 degrees.
Right.
Change.
And yes. And you can't really explain why it happened. Just confronting death was what finally did it?
My answer to that is that I think that normally all human beings in the last minute, human beings, I mean the body, I'm not talking about the consciousness or the mind, but the body always wants to survive. That is something we have in our inside.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So our body wants to survive. It doesn't matter how, it wants to survive. So when I was so close to death, that thing from my body that was saying that I didn't want that, then I hear my body. That's the whole question. I hear for the first time maybe in a lot of years, I hear my body saying that this wasn't the thing I want for me. And then all started to change. And then I wanted to recover. I wanted to go out. I wanted to try good things in life. I want to see the beautiful side of life and
right.
all that.
And I presume that when you were on the street, you were separated from your family?
Yes.
And did that eventually change?
Yes, of course. And I have to say that that was one of the main things that helped me a lot when it's in the hospital. Because when I was admitted at the hospital, they told me, well, what is your family, to call them? And I say, no, I don't want you to call them. This is something I did for myself, and I don't want to get my family involved in this. I was already a few years out of my house, and I was living in the streets, and I didn't talk and I didn't see my family for many, many times. Someone passed in this isolation room, because it was very strange to see people in this room. Then everybody was looking inside, and someone who knew my family saw me, and then at the end my family arrived there. And then when they arrived, they just opened their arms, and even we have fight a lot of fight before because of the addiction and all the problems that you can imagine because of the addiction. But in this moment that I was very bad, they were on my side, and they were caring for me, and I feel them, that they were there. My family and my sisters were mostly the whole day there with me, and to feel that they were there for me was very important for overcome that situation.
Sounds like in your case that you had really no lower to go, and that you bounced back. I'm sure that most people would have felt that you didn't have a chance at that time.
That was my last chance. My last, very last chance, because you have to know that that what you're saying for me was an obsession to know where the limits were. You know, it's like what was the limit between life and death? You know? And I used to work a lot of times in that very limit of.
Right.
Yeah, it was an obsession for me.
Right. You were diagnosed HIV negative when you went into the hospital for your surgery. You were HIV hepatitis C positive, but you were HIV negative. So when did they diagnose you HIV positive?
Like 3 years after that. 3 years when I already went out of the hospital and I was recovering very well and very quickly.
Right.
Yeah. The doctors were amazing because of my quick recovering.
Right. So around 1998.
That's it, 1998.
So 20 years ago. And what has been your explanation for why you became HIV positive? Because they could have said, if you had been HIV positive in the hospital, they would have said, well, you've been probably sharing needles. That's why you became HIV positive. But you were HIV negative at the time you were at the worst with your drug addiction. And after you recovered your health and you had stopped taking drugs. I mean, did you take drugs after the heart surgery, or did you? Was that it?
No, that was it. Well, I continued smoking cigarettes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I tried even in 95, I stopped having alcohol, drinking alcohol.
Right.
So I don't drink alcohol also for 20 years.
Right.
But I remember I keep on smoking for a few years more after my heart surgery. But never again heroin or any drug like that.
But as far as I know, nobody's ever blamed cigarettes for HIV.
No.
So really, if you were going to, if the infectious theory of HIV is correct, you should have been HIV positive in 1995, and it shouldn't have waited 3 years. But what is your explanation for why you suddenly became HIV positive during your recovery?
Answer is because I did the test.
Okay.
Yes.
In some of what you wrote, you implied that you feel that the 21 units of foreign blood that were transfused were the reasons for the antibodies that tested positive.
Yes, yes. And for me, it's clear that with the explanation of the official theory of the infectious theory of AIDS. If I was negative in the hospital in 95, I could have been positive in that time because I shared needles and I did a lot of things. And even in sex, the behavior was like anything was admitted in those days. And before that, I mean, after that, I didn't do nothing. I mean, I just was recovering very well, very quickly.
Right.
So what was the difference? Those units of blood that they put me into my body. And my explanation is because my body did a response to a foreign matter that was coming into the body. Mm-hmm. And my defense system had to be working a lot. Producing a lot of antibodies and producing a lot of other responses to this big amount of blood that came into my body.
Right.
And that's why a non-specific test that mostly the best we can say is that the test is valid for antibodies or non-specific antibodies. So in this case, the antibodies, I think, that made the test turned positive.
Did you test between 1995 and 1998, or just at the hospital and in 1998?
No, it was just at the hospital. And because I was HIV negative in 95, so I just forget about it.
Right.
And then it was, and this is something very stupid, but the reality is like that. In the health system, the doctor that was treating me, I changed my house, and then I had to move to other part of the city, and then I have to change doctor. And this new doctor, he told me that if I did the test, if I haven't done the test since I was out of the hospital, and I said no, why? It was negative. It was everything okay. And look, I am the well. I am improving my health, and so what he told me very seriously, and looking at my face, said, oh, but you are from this group.
He means drug addicted.
Drug addicted.
Right.
And he said, no, because you are in this group, you have to keep on testing. And at that time, I didn't know nothing about AIDS or about dissidents or nothing.
But he knew that you were no longer taking drugs.
Yes, of course. So, well, maybe this doctor thinks that I was lying and I was taking drugs. I don't know, but he said because of I was from this group of people, that the people taking drugs or people that has an past of drug addiction, mm-hmm. then I had to do the test regularly, you know. Mm-hmm. And then he sent me to the lab and I did the test because I just thought it sounds strange because it's like I was celebrating a party, being looking at myself the good I was doing with my health and all that. And he came to my party just to switch off the music and say no, you have to go and do the test. So
yes.
I was angry a bit, and it didn't sound good for me, no.
Right.
But I went and did the test, and then came positive.
And so, what were your thoughts about being diagnosed HIV positive? I mean, did you accept it as a death sentence? Did you reject it right away? Did you just kind of put things off? Like, how did you react to it?
To answer that, I have to say first that in my recovering from 95 to, let's say, 98, when the diagnosis came, in these 3 years, I just read a lot of books about improving health in a natural way, the natural hygiene point of view of medicine.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they handle diet, and also they make fasting.
Right.
And things like that, and I was quite critic with the conventional medicine, and I was going into this discovering of a natural way of improving my health. In this knowledge that I was discovering in this natural hygiene point of view, then came the diagnosis. So I was in one point I was already critic with the medicine, with the health system, or
critical of what we might call allopathic medicine.
That's it, with allopathic medicine.
Which definitely has its benefits. I think allopathic medicine is very good at fixing up some of the problems our society creates. So when it comes to war, allopathic medicine is very good at saving the lives of soldiers who's being shot. And in your case, after years of taking chemicals, it was very good at fixing your heart.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is something I have to thank to the allopathic medicine. But because I see also this point, that allopathic medicine, I say, that is good for accidents. Mm-hmm. Something that is not constructed, that is, sudden, something that happened.
Right, and relatively isolated. Like, it seems to have much more difficulty when something affects your whole body. Like a neurological condition, with an unknown cause, like depression, for example, it has a hard time dealing with those kinds of things. I didn't want to divert you, but you were skeptical of allopathic medicine. So did you ever consider taking the AIDS drugs, which I'm sure were recommended?
No. In this moment, that in 98, when I got the diagnosis, for me, it was like something very strange was happening. Because if in my worst days I was HIV negative, and now that I was so well recovering and so well improving my health, I was HIV positive, then I said, well, this doesn't make sense to me. So I didn't take what the doctor told me with this diagnosis. And then I start looking in this natural point of view, and then I find a book. I found a book that was with Bob Owen. He wrote Roger Recovered from AIDS.
Okay, I have never read that.
It treats the AIDS phenomenon from the point of view of the natural hygiene point of view. So it was for me, it was fantastic to find this book. And then I start questioning.
And how did Roger recover from AIDS in the book? Like, what was described in terms of the recovery?
Well, it was the case of two doctors that came from Vietnam at the end of the war. One, he worked as a doctor, a normal doctor, and the other one was under addiction of heroin. And he couldn't make it. I mean, he couldn't do it well. And he started going down in this spiral of addiction. Mm-hmm. And at the end, he was very, very bad condition of health in general. And then he took the test and it was found positive.
Right.
And then the health system just give him like a few months of life.
Right.
And then he went to see his friend the friend wasn't a specialist, not a virologist, nothing. It was just, how do you say,
general practitioner.
General practitioner. Mm-hmm. And then he needs to start looking everything. And that was something good for him, because he didn't have all this influence of what is said about HIV and AIDS.
What we might call preconceptions or assumptions about AIDS.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it was a doctor that it was not brainwashed because it was a general practitioner, and probably he didn't have any patients with AIDS. Mm-hmm. And so as he wanted to help his friend, mm-hmm. he started looking at all, but from the beginning. And then he started questioning also, and then he realized there were some things that didn't make sense and that didn't fit. So he went deeply into that, and then he found that all this science was quite bad science.
Speaking of that, we've briefly mentioned the tests, and I know that you have looked at the test labels. Like most people yes. who've had an HIV test might not realize it, but there's a label of maybe 20 pages that describes a lot of things about the test, some of it practical information about how you run the test, what temperature it has to be stored at, that kind of stuff. But some of it is interesting admissions as to the limitations of the test and the fact that the test is not 100% reliable and that there's no gold standard. But when it comes to things that are wrong with the HIV/AIDS theory, like what are the things that stick out in your mind?
Well, for me, it's the isolation of the virus. That we are talking about a virus that, for me, I am I read a lot the Perth group and Stefan mm-hmm. Lanka and all the scientists that for me make more sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the isolation of the virus is something that still haven't been done correctly. And so if we don't have a virus, all the rest that you were saying is just approximations to truth, but nothing more than that.
And that's really what the HIV test kit labels are saying. Because if you could purify the virus from blood, even if it was a very expensive and time-consuming and laborious process, you could use that to validate the HIV antibody tests or some other kind of test if you had an isolation procedure. Like you could take blood and you could say, here's 100 samples and we can isolate HIV, and here's 100 samples we can't isolate HIV, and then you run the test, and if you get 99 positive over here and 99 negative over here, you would say, okay, the test is 99% accurate. But without isolation, you can't do that.
Yes, that's it. That for me, that's the main problem. And then, as we don't have a proper test to see if we have the virus, or even if the virus is the cause of AIDS, that is, then we go into the work of Peter Duesberg and all that other part that he says it cannot be the cause.
Yes,
but he admits that the virus exists.
Yes, that's true. I think that. Peter Duesberg's focus on drug abuse and AIDS is the high point of his research, where he's correlated the AIDS epidemic and the illnesses to the immense drug problem in the United States and other places.
Yes, I'm very I agree a lot with Peter Duesberg in that.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's like the drug addiction or the drugs, the use of drugs in those moments of the beginning of the AIDS crisis.
Right.
The all the 70s and the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s. It's for me, it's quite clear that the main cause of all that crisis was drugs. But maybe not only that, because it was not only drugs, I mean, not only illegal drugs or recreational drugs, but also other things.
Like AZT?
But the main, the AZT was later on in the 80s.
Right, in the late 80s, yes.
In the 80s. But in the beginning, when they were people dying, and they didn't know, I mean, before 84, there were people dying. They was looking for the cause. And they didn't, the paper from Luc Montagnier came in 83 and then Robert Gallo 84. But in those years before, there were people dying. And they had a condition, a crisis. They had something happen to them that we cannot deny that. I cannot deny that. But of course, for me, the cause of that was the drugs. In combination with other things, but the main thing is drugs.
I think of the drugs in three categories from a point of view of AIDS. There are the injected recreational drugs, there are the pharmaceutical drugs, and then there are the non-injected drugs like poppers. And the AIDS theory will admit that injected drugs can be a problem because they believe that those can transmit HIV. But they never believe that pharmaceutical drugs or poppers or other non-injected drugs can be a problem.
Well, but you know the works that show the relation between Poppers and Kaposi sarcoma.
Mm-hmm.
That was very clear. That has something to do, Poppers, with Kaposi sarcoma. For me, it was also something very, very important in those days for a cause of the crisis is the antibioticum, the Bactrim and Ceftriaxone.
Yes, recently somebody sent me a BBC interview with Dr. Joseph Sonnabend. I don't know if you know the name Sonnabend.
Yes, of course.
But yes, but he was quite controversial because he believed in the multifactorial theory, a little bit like Luc Montagnier, and that got him into some trouble as the orthodoxy improved. But at that time, doctors, I don't know Dr. Joseph Sonnabend's prescribing practices, so I don't want to blame him for this, but a lot of doctors were handing out antibiotics to gay men who were suffering from recurrent sexually transmitted diseases. And so antibiotics and steroids and other drugs were being handed out like candy to the gay community that was also doing a lot of drugs like poppers.
Yes, of course. I remember reading a paper in the 70s to a big crisis that was coming, and that I'm talking about the 70s.
Right.
In the 70s, doctors already did an alert to the medical community to say that something big and something quite important, I mean, a crisis was going to come, because they were giving the most toxic antibiotic available at that time. They were giving like not for weeks, and even more than weeks. And even the people, when they had these sexual transmitted diseases one time and again, then they do it by themselves. They didn't go to the doctor, so they just knew, because the doctor always prescribed the same antibioticum, so they took the not going to the doctor. And then the use of the antibioticum like something that you could have, that you could take. It was like a prophylaxis use of antibioticum, because they knew they were going, when they're going out again in the weekend, they're going to get all again the sexually transmitted diseases. So they took in advance, they took the antibioticum. So the use of antibioticum was widely spread.
Right.
I mean, so at that time, something so strong, because the antibioticum, the first damage to our body is the gut flora. And then when that is swept out, then you don't have any defense. Your body is lacking of defense.
Right.
And then something else happens.
I've always felt that one of the tragic ironies in the gay community in the 1980s was that they could have blamed a drug problem. And as you pointed out, it wasn't just poppers, but also overuse of pharmaceutical drugs, or they could blame their sexuality. And they chose to say that the reason why we're getting sick is because we're having so much sex, and that's causing us to transmit this virus, as opposed to, along with this new sexual liberation, has become an overuse of drugs, and we need to deal with that. And there were gay men, like, for example, the man at the conference, John Lauritsen, who were warning the gay community about the use of poppers. And I'm sure there were people warning about the overuse of antibiotics, but nobody was listening.
I agree that the homosexual community, they did a bad choice, blaming on the sexuality instead of their practices, not sexual practices, but the way they had fun, you know, the way they party. So I think it's some kind of lack of honesty to themselves, or a lack of, how do you say, autocritica. I don't know how do you say in English, self-criticism.
Self-criticism, yeah, yes, I agree. And it's not just the gay community that has a drug problem. It's just different than the heterosexual community. The drugs that are used are different. But certainly what's been documented in the 1980s in the fast track gay community was a huge amount of sex, and the drugs were linked to that, to help you stay up later, to deal with the STDs, all kinds of things. In your life, like recovering health, like what are the things that you changed in your life apart from stopping drugs that helped you recover and get back to a state of good health?
Okay, when I left drugs, when I stopped the drugs, one thing I could do, very simple, was dealing with the diet. Mm-hmm. Because diet is something that we do normally like 3 times a day, all the days of our lives.
Yes.
So if we don't quite well, if we don't look after that, if we do it in a wrong way, three times a day, all the days of 1 year and all the years of our life, maybe in 40 years, in 30 years, we could have a big problem. Actually, many of the problems that are today first causes of death in nearly in all Western countries, it's related to diet. I mean, there are a lot of problems.
Diabetes is probably the most straightforward disease that I think is related to a high carbohydrate diet.
Yes, but not only diabetes. Yes. There are a lot of like cholesterol.
No,
and so that was something easy. I started doing the vegetarian diet at those days in 1996 when I went out of the hospital, because I was 2 years without this tricuspid valve.
Right.
So from the 4 valves of a heart, I had only 3.
Right.
For 2 years. And then in 2 years, they replaced my valve and they put me a metal valve.
Right.
So in these 2 years, I just asked the doctor what was the best diet I could do. And they say, or they give me recommendations. And they just said, it's good for you to have a diet without animal fat.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, okay, which is the less fat, the less animal fat diet? And it's the vegetarian. So I went vegetarian. And then I was for maybe 16 or 15 years vegetarian. Now I am 6 years vegan. I just quit also dairy products and eggs and honey and all that. And it was every time I did a change in the diet, it was something I could feel in my daily life, that I had a better digestion, that I could sleep better.
Right.
So for me, the diet was something crucial. But also emotions was something also that I had to deal with from the beginning when I went out of the hospital. This was something I did, but that was not so easy as diet.
Right, right. That tends to be what harms a lot of people, not being able to get on top of that. I mean, where did these negative emotions come from and how did you resolve them?
I learned to not call in negative emotions or positive emotions, but emotions that we have. And maybe it could sound crazy, but everything that we did, even for me, the addiction or maybe other circumstances, we do it for a reason. And that reason is it's logic. It has a logic. But the logic maybe is from a neurotical point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But neurosis is also something that it has a reason. But of course, the point is that we keep on doing things that today there is no point to do it, but we're still doing it. I mean, there are like learned responses that we have memorized, and then we keep on repeating this, that maybe one in the past that was successful, And now we repeat it once and again. And that is the problem. But negative emotions mostly is from the past, from the beginning of our lives.
Right.
I mean, I remember when I went through, because I study also, I did study also Gestalt. Mm-hmm. This is therapy, a psychotherapy that lead mainly with emotions. And I did 4 years of this formation. And for me, it was like going into the deep of the emotions. And that took me to my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember a lot of things that I have forgotten, but they were there and they were causing an effect to my organ, but without me knowing it, you know?
Right.
So I had to discover this and to learn why was it that, and why did I respond in that way, and if today it still makes sense to respond in the same way. That was all.
So you're basically saying that you had learned responses to certain conditions, and you had to change how you reacted to conditions?
Yes, it's not that simple, but you could say so.
Okay.
it's much more complicated.
I mean, are you better at dealing with stress, or do you try to reduce the amount of stress in your life?
Yes, I think it's like the long way to resolve stress is to go back and deep into the causes.
Mm-hmm.
If I want to resolve stress in the short way, because I don't want to feel stressed and because I see the negative point of stress, but I don't want to go deep into all the causes, then that wouldn't last long. I mean, it would have an effect, maybe a short effect. But I choose to do the long way, you know, to go deep to where is all this coming from.
So with some of these things in your childhood, do you feel that you've just accepted them so that you can move on? Or how would you deal with something?
Of course, for me, my great discovery, if I can say it in a few words, was to go back to the childhood, meet again the child I was,
mm-hmm.
Say to him that he is not guilty of anything that happened, and that I embrace him, and I can feel compassion for him, and I want to care.
I was going to say that because you're dealing with things in your childhood, you cannot change what happened. But what you're saying is, in a sense, you have gone back and changed those things. Or at least you've changed how you remember them, or how you feel about them now.
Yes, I think the point is not trying to change, because of course there are things that happened and I cannot change it.
Mm-hmm.
That is it. But what I can do for to live with that is to understand. That's the whole point. Because there was a reason to be that way, and I have to find out.
Yes.
So I have to dig deep, and I have to discover why was that so, and what was the reason, and to understand and forgive,
mm-hmm.
and to be compassionate with, not doing it in a hard move that I want to find guilties here or there.
Yes. You know? Yes.
It's different. It's like I don't want to blame my mother or my father, or I don't want to blame society, or I don't want to blame. That's not the way. I mean, it's something that I want to learn from myself and for myself. So society and my parents is something apart.
That's interesting, because it seems that when you hear about children who had bad things happen in their childhood, that the most popular thing is to go do something about that. You know, punish the person who did the bad things to you, as opposed to rebuilding the relationship. And of course, it depends what those people did to you. But I think most children have things in their past, things they wish they hadn't done, and also things that were done to them that they still feel are hurting. But what's the point in having 80-year-old parents who you're still angry at because of something they did 50, 60 years ago?
Yes, and probably what they did was something also they didn't know why they did it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are all repeating, you know.
Yes.
Maybe they didn't realize their fathers did to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't overcome that situation, and they just repeat. Because here is like two ways. Is or you discover what was happening there, and then you can understand, and from there you can go in a way not repeating, because mm-hmm. you have understood. But the other way is if I just want to blame, and I'm very close to repeat it again, because I haven't mm-hmm. understand, and probably then that's mentioned a lot of times in many fields of psychotherapy and psychology and all that, is the person that have been victims of abuse there in the future, if they don't overcome that properly, probably they will be abuse to other people.
They will become a perpetrator. I mean, one thing I have discovered in my life is the futility of anger under most circumstances. I mean, there is a time and a place for anger. If you're truly threatened, it can be useful. But in most cases, it's just an inability to deal with some problem, some dispute, a different way of looking at things. And if you can find a more creative way to deal with things that doesn't involve anger, like often just thinking about why do I feel angry about this, sometimes yep. reveals that I have insecurities about it. I have guilty feelings, and it's much easier to turn those around and be angry at somebody else than it is to look at yourself and calm yourself down and then try to find a creative way to resolve the problem, because there's usually a problem mixed up with your own emotions.
Yes, of course. But it's also a very important point that is that we cannot refuse or neglect our emotions. Mm-hmm. Even anger needs its expression, and if we don't express that, maybe we will have problems. The point is how to express that, not hurting others.
Right. The way I've discovered, maybe this is just with me, is that what happens is I'm feeling frustrated about something, and then I see an opportunity to be angry. And it's not even very important. But instead of dealing with the frustrations, I end up focusing on, or I have, I don't do it so much, but I've ended up focusing on that little thing that became my excuse for being angry, right? As yeah. opposed to dealing with the bigger thing, that I didn't have an excuse for being angry, because part of it might have been my fault. And anyway, that's just my way of dealing with these things.
Yes, but maybe what you say from frustration, if you are angry because things didn't success or things went wrong, and you see you couldn't do nothing, and then you are frustrated and then you are angry, that's like a kind of anger. Then maybe you still have some space to look for other responses. But there are angers that comes when someone is going to abuse you, or is going to treat you
yes.
bad, And there, those kind of anger, I mean, that kind of anger that comes when these things happen, maybe doesn't let you many space if you are not... normally what we do is we have immediate response. We don't even think. I mean,
right.
Like mechanic.
Right. I agree that anger sometimes is useful, but sometimes it just is a very inefficient and damaging way to deal with with problems that are relatively minor, and maybe a way not to deal with the problems inside yourself, just to try to dump everything on somebody else. But what I've also learned is that anger produces anger in response, and so it generally doesn't resolve the problem. Anyway, that's our psychology. We've been talking a long time. We only have a couple of minutes left. I don't know if you'd close out by, like, perhaps you could talk a little bit about how you've helped other people in Spain who've been dealing with HIV diagnoses or other health crises.
Yes, I have a website, and I have my telephone number in my web.
And what's the website called?
Replanteamientodelasalud.blogspot.com.
Okay.
I can pass you...
Yes, email it to me so I write it right.
Later on. And then you can find my telephone there, and then a lot of people that call me because they have received this diagnosis, and they want to find out, they want to look for more information.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that is something very helpful, because I remember that for me it was like, how can I say, when I first received the diagnosis, I remember that I was shocked. I didn't believe it, but I was still shocked. And for maybe 2 or 3 months, I didn't tell anybody about it. And I was just trying to make sense in my mind. I did that helped me a lot was I didn't go mad about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't start all this spiral of paranoid or. So that is very important, because once you start with this intense fear and this paranoid and all that, then your body becomes stressed, and maybe it could be that some signs of illness appears.
Right.
That is the worst thing that it can happen to a person that has been diagnosed for that, for HIV infection, to start feeling bad or seeing that there are signs of symptoms of illness.
Mm-hmm.
So in my little work that I do is to help people to stay calm and start to look in information, to promote criticism, to promote critical thinking, and to look for their own survey and their own opinion of what has been said to them. And the same way that I did it for myself. And apart from that, what I do also is I go to little audiences, someplace, some here, there. In Madrid, I have been several times, by Valencia, also here in Malaga and other cities here in Spain. And I share all this information. Mm-hmm. I just want to share with people. And I want to see, I want to confront. I have seen, excuse me, I have seen that it's very important for this terrible phenomenon called AIDS. I find very important that people go out of the closet. Most people go out of the closet, but that is something very, very difficult, because normally it happens in people that they are already marginalized, they are already discriminated, they are already, how do you say, well, that normally it happens in people that they are drug addicts or gay, so they are in other closets. It's like you,
right,
it's like gay people are in the gay closet.
Right,
but also in the HIV closet.
Right.
And so sometimes it's like one. in another.
And I think one of the most powerful things that you can give is that you're simply your story of having survived 20 years with an HIV diagnosis without AIDS drugs. Simply that must be very calming to people to know that it's possible, that you don't have to go on the drugs tomorrow, that people can take an alternative route. And you know, maybe they might not immediately think it's going to work for everybody, but at least they know it's worked for some people and that it is a plausible route.
Yes. In my last year, I have been coming together with people that are on a different point of view, that are mm-hmm. taking medicines and that are believing in the HIV, in the infections theory. Mm-hmm. But we find that we still have things in common that are bad for us, for them and for me, and that we have to deal with together. The best way is to deal and against the system, a system that is not justice. And so I, in my point now is to go and meet these people. Meet the other diagnosed mm-hmm. people that they are taking meds, because it's all a big story that is always exposed as there are one people that there are officialists and there are other people that there are dissidents, and the dissidents call the other official, the officials call the other denialists.
Right, right.
It's like a big fight that it doesn't take us anywhere.
It's not productive.
For me, I have seen even in this... in this part of the dissident, I have seen that this is not an issue. I mean, it's like we talk a lot about science, we talk a lot about laboratory technical point or a lot of things, but I am missing a big part in this dissident's view, and is that we are diagnosed people and we have our problems, because it doesn't matter if the infectious theory is correct or not. We have the problem in the streets, and we have been marginalized, and that's a fact.
Yes.
Even if the infectious theory is wrong,
right?
But we still have problems.
Yes.
Problems of discrimination, problems of all that. So I am not now in a point to fight with the official part or that. Instead of that, I'm going to find them and I'm going to encounter with them, and then we try to fight together, unless in the things that there are common for us, for both.
Thank you for spending time with me and sharing your life experience and also your thoughts about health and HIV and other things. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure for me, David. Thanks to you.
Okay. Thank you, Raul. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 186 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.